When you're listening to this podcast, you're using the benefits, the fruits of evolution. So 100 million years ago or so, a fish swam out of the sea, beached itself on the land, and eventually began to have legs and walk, etc. That's the evolutionary tale, if you believe it. But it no longer used its gills, it used lungs. And no longer using its gills, it had special, all fish have little bones to operate their gills. Now these bones were no longer used, and indeed you have your three in one ear, three in the other, three original little bones which you used to operate your gills are now used to transmit vibration from your eardrum to a beautiful sort of musical instrument, a fluid-filled musical instrument, a little sea in a coil, a little snail-shaped thing called a cochlea. And the cochlea is lined with thousands of nerves, and you can hear exquisite sounds that fish can't hear. Fish don't have ears, they've got gills. Amazing little story there. Now, this was a piece of evidence, amongst any other, lots of other pieces of evidence, that supported the idea of evolution. Yes, an idea of evolution 150 years before Darwin. And the person at the centre of this is Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck. Yes, and you probably could work out where he's from. He's from France. He's a nobleman in France who, with changing fortunes, and he's had a few unfortunate mishaps in his life, has become a scientist in the King's Garden. Forgive my French accent, there's none. There is no French accent. My Australian accent has completely. But Jardin de Roy means Roy, mate. It means the garden of the king. And now, this is where we're going to start to dig back in history, and I'll discuss this a little bit further. But the king wanted to be healthy. He needed medicines, and to have every medicine, he needed to grow lots of trees. So originally, the king's garden from Mother Louise, established in Paris, was to grow exotic trees so that the king may have the best medicines to cure the king's diseases. Pity about the rest of the population. Now, we're going to go back in history and look at a few of the basic mechanics of what's going on here. So you should be impressed at this point in time, unless you knew it already, that you are listening with your gills. Come and tune your gills in to listen to them. And it's indeed a fascinating discovery, which tended to confirm my Jean-Baptiste de Lamarck, or as we people know him, because we try to compare Darwin and Lamarck. And Lamarck being French, and earlier he got things wrong and done and dusted and reconducted a series of crude pre-genetics experiments to prove him thoroughly wrong, and Britannia rules the waves. It's a fantastic British triumph, Charles Darwin. And they often focus Darwin's fight against creationists, but there's another bigger fight between Lamarck and Darwin, between the Nazis and the communists, believe it or not. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific, always trying to improve the way produce podcasts and lay ideas out. And with this, I've hopefully got you in about the subject of evolution. I'm not going to go too much into it, just saying that there are forces, and that creatures gradually change generation after generations into different species. So we started off as a shrew 100 million years ago, and eventually, here you have it, you've got some of us have turned into humans, others to orangutans, others to apes. That's the evolutionary theory that's taught at school. But to understand Lamarck, to make him more than just a remark in a textbook, as I've come across him, as the person who got it wrong. We need to dig into the actual earth or his environment. Now, how he got it wrong, what he basically said is that he had a basic idea that if you have two animals, let's call them Mr. and Mrs. Short-necked Giraffe, they go around and they want to reach food which is slightly higher up, and so they stretch their necks, and then they do what Mr. and Mrs. Giraffe do after having stretched their necks a little bit. They go and have some giraffe babies, and lo and behold, the babies come out not overall bigger, but their necks are a little bit bigger. And so the process continues, and then dramatically over a very short period of evolutionary time, we have the giraffes going from an antelope or a horse type animal, and you have your modern day giraffe. And it seemed to make a lot of sense, and we nowadays would say, we'd scoff the idea of saying, before you get married, let's play a lot of tennis so our children will be great tennis players. And that's probably misinterpreting what Lamarck is really saying in the grand scope, but that's one of the ways that you can sort of make fun of it. You know, people are saying, well, obviously it doesn't work, because the way we've taught you, you obviously know that you get marked correct in tests are saying that Mr. and Mrs. Giraffe had three giraffe children, one with a short neck, medium-sized neck, long-sized neck, and a little neck one could never reach the food, got really weak, began to cry, and eventually died before they could go on and have more giraffe babies. So overall, taking the overall fraction of neck lengths, this natural selection worked on. I won't go into it too much, but the story of Lamarck and how he invented so many institutions like the modern, open Museum of Natural History, open to the public, and a whole feast of things that he did, and the and the world that he was in, and the and he was not knocked off by creationists. He was knocked off by creationists. He was knocked off by people who were saying, look, animals don't evolve, they just go extinct. And let's look at it. Let's go from the start of time. Fortunately, at the start of time, the Egyptians mummified things. And so here's modern-day ibis, and here's an ibis that I've mummified earlier. Look, there's no difference. Your theory is totally wrong. It's an amazing amount of hard science accepted at the time to disprove our hero, Lamarck, and at various points in time, there was one scientist who chops off heaps of mice tails. It's sort of like out of a nursery rhyme or something like that, in an effort to disprove him. So fundamentally, there's a hunch, a feeling that he's wrong, and there's all these poor attempts to disprove this poor person. And of course, modern science is showing tantalizing evidence that at least in some aspects he is right. There is transmission of physical physical characteristics back into the sperm and egg. This is another way of saying from my body to the sperm and egg. The way that you would say that is from the soma to the germ. So the soma is everything else besides the sperm and egg, the brain, the eyes, the nose, the tongue, and everything else like that. And the germ is the sperm and egg, and it's the genetic information, the sperm and egg, which gets carried on. So you, the sperm and egg goes and produces the soma cells, and that's the end of the story, typically. But however, there is some modern tantalizing evidence which we can't get to in this first introductory episode about DNA. DNA is the blueprint. RNA is the messenger, or the actual if you like, photocopier of the DNA, but there's reverse transcription. That is, the photocopy message gets back into the DNA, and all bets are open. We can do amazing stuff now. And so the sure conclusion of the scientist who was chopping off all the mice's tails, and even Richard Dawkins, a whole lot of things where they're absolutely sure the bets are really open. But let's get back into the world of Lamarck. And de Lamarck, it's, the de is like von or lord. It's a noble stuff, and he's sort of put that a little bit aside because he was struggling in many ways at the start of the French Revolution, and he was cast out of science as the institutions were being crushed and squeezed. He fell out, and he captured the flavor of the revolution and used the flavor of the revolution to create a powerhouse of French science, not powered by himself, but he gave the blueprint, and he used the media and the flavor of the time to move it forward. So the French Revolution, look, the thing is that there are so many things happening at the same time. It's sort of like everyone has been quiet in history, and all at the same time, everyone says, you can talk, and it's absolutely full of different systems going through, and you have to look left and right. There's metrics coming up, but there's three different metric systems coming up. There's different methods of government coming up. There's the lids have been taken off, and human creativity mixed with a bit of starvation and with a bit of guillotines got things, put a real bomb under it. And obviously ripping down big institutions where they would say, you can't do that, I'm going to the king, or he's lost his head. But before that, we have to wise up and give you some good old Australian version of European history. Now, Europeans and other countries have spent years studying it, and we come in, listen to an episode, and we miss bits and pieces. And so let's, in this episode, as a forerunner to Lamarck, talk about the basis of the French Revolution. So Lamarck is in France, he's in Paris, in the French Revolution. And we have to really go back to 100 years or so before, when they had the last meeting of the three estates, of the three amigos, the three estates. And you may have heard the word estates. Estates means sort of class functional group. We don't have an estate or many estates at the moment. It's an ancient idea, but lots of things were happening in Europe, and it was good politics to at least nominally take the people along with you if you have to conduct a war and then raise soldiers and raise taxes to conduct a war. It can be rather lost onto the man in the street. So they had a system of three estates. Now, this is going to lead to the French Revolution in a very, very simple way. I'm going to simplify it for you all, sort of the science version of it all. And so you had the three estates. So the first estate, obviously, is the king and the everyone who goes to the royal wedding, not the celebrities, which is probably another estate here, but the dukes and the, I don't know what, the French royalties, all the different noblemen, the noble people, the people running the shop. Then the second state is the church. And that's the way it is, the church. So obviously you have to be a priest, a bishop, or something a bit holy to be in the church. And the third estate is the anyone who's not in the first or second estate is just the businessman, nominally the serfs and the peasants and all that type of people. Peasants really probably wouldn't know what was going on. So, 1650s, crunch times comes in 1789, so it's a few hundred years later. It was the last meeting where the king consulted with three estates, to have a vote. So what happens is that you have a chamber with the three estates represented, and they have a majority vote between the three estates. So you've got the political industrial, not the industrialists, the actual mercantile functionary civil service type of peasants, everything, people who aren't clergy or noble, the clergy and the noble, and they have to get two out of three to get a piece of basically legislation or law, which usually means raising money or putting people towards war or funding the king or something like that. History passed. There's a bit of European history going on in the 18th century, which is from 1700 to 1799. I suppose that's what the 18th century is called. And what's happening is things aren't going well from France. France is having a bit of a bustle match with Britain, and Britain's sort of giving France a bit of a bloody nose. Things aren't very well organised because there's a big flourishing of Enlightenment, and people are off wondering about the universe. They're not organising themselves all that well, reforms are not generally happening. And as happens, there's a series of bad crops. People are going a bit hungry. There's a bit of unrest. So fundamentally, if you can feed them, you can keep them happy. So people are a bit unrestful, and there's been several kings. There's Louis 14th, 15th, up to Louis 16th time, and it's time to actually talk about raising taxes. And people are invited to the fabulous, sumptuous castle of Versailles. The king's development centre of Louis the 16th. And the three estates are going to meet again. So it doesn't really sound like democracy or government that we really understand. And it's certainly not, you know, a responsive group, but it's now crisis, crunch time. And this is a piece of history. It sort of narrows it down to a time, a place, an event. And so estate number one goes in, estate number two goes in, they lock the door. Estate number three goes to open the door to get it in. This is a group of businessmen and common people go in. They can't get in. And so they go to a disused indoor tennis court in Versailles. That's right, a tennis court. Now, tennis obviously has got many French origins, including the name. Tenier means to hold, and as you throw up the ball, you say tenier, or whatever they did. So that's how it became known as tennis. So they go to this tennis court, and I sort of rather think this is a bit amazing. So these people are out, ready to make decisions, and they decide to start up a government. So if they're cut out of government, they're going to make a government. So you get a hold of people who are potentially good leaders, get them to discuss issues of government, and then you lock them out and put them in a room. And of course, they came up with the basic French Revolution. Of course, their idea is that they're going to be a bit more powerful. The king will still be there. And so the king lasts another two or so years before the French people are actually quite... a few months after that, there's a real decisive... things go a little bit more ugly in terms of the French go to Bastille Day. So they tend to note Bastille Day because that's all hands-on. That's sort of the famous locking the door and meeting in a tennis court is not as dramatic as storming a prison and taking the weapons. And that's a real sort of revolutionary fever. Of course, it dies down for a year or two until they go to Versailles, because it's a world of fake news and Twitter, and someone has pamphleted that there's food aplenty in Versailles, and people go, oh, worth the walk. They go up there, a female group go up there and shake up the place, and that shaking up the place is the story of their releasing of animals, releases the animals, which are released and collected again in the Jardin de Plantes, which starts the Museum of Natural History. It's an amazing story, but it's these basic facts, the key, the locking key, the meeting of the tennis courts, the three estates, they're pretty concrete things to think about building up the start of the French Revolution. Of course, the French Revolution, as you read it, is sort of mind-bogglingly complex with people talking on top of each other. It's almost as though you're trying to pick up, get a police statement of what's happening, and everyone speaks at the same time, sort of reading through it. Now, that sets the stage for Lamarck to sail left to field and take control and put French science and evolution on a footing that's not been seen before. Just as sort of a parallel example, Australians will swear black and blue that the British did not invade the United States in 1812 and did not burn down the White House. You cannot convince them of this or many other facts or constructs of history. And again, no one has heard of the actual basis of the French Revolution. The question that everyone asks is, what has been the fallout of the French Revolution? And even my friends ask that, what is the fallout? And to sound profound, there's someone who's always quoted, the answer to that is, it's too early to say. And one of the things is that the French Revolution has put into motion things which the world is still working out. It's been a positive thing, but it's a complex thing to talk about. So this is a surprising start, starting off with your fish bones in your ears. What's that going about? Is that evolution? And to do the first chapter in it, we've gone back to the actual structure of the French Revolution, where the forces are all pent up, and there's rapid evolution and rapid survival of the fittest, survival, basic killing off of certain people. Thanks for listening. This is Peter Till Explains, and I'm focusing on just one idea at a time and making it as clear as possible. In the meantime, keep on thinking science, doing science, and teaching science.